Hey everyone, back again. Today we're going to finish off Edward Said's The Question of Palestine with chapters 3 and 4. So before jumping into it, you know who I am. If you don't, go check out episodes 1 and 2. If you wanna felt like contributing, you can do so to one of the organizations listed below. Also, because I think it's really worth your time, if you can find a way to watch Israelism, I really recommend it. It's a really great documentary. It's normally, unfortunately, stuck behind a paywall. It's like $5. Highly recommend you going and watching that if you have the means to. Now, to keep you updated, and I'm surprised, I thought there'd be a little bit more backlash, but there hasn't been. Just a few people. Apparently I'm a propaganda person now, or spreading propaganda with this stuff. But I'm not paid by any state, so I don't know. I don't think that's the case. Being too emotional, yes, you'll know about it. I mean, it's impossible. Given what's going on right now, it's impossible, I think, not to be emotional. I think being non-emotional is to be unobjective, because it's a sign that you don't feel anything. And to witness any amount of the carnage that's going on in Gaza right now, that was the passive voice, sorry, Israel's violence in Gaza right now, then, and you feel nothing, I mean, then that should be cause for concern, I think. You know, seeing these images of people standing out in these fields of barren wasteland, of their homes having been destroyed, just surrounded by the rubble of everything they once knew, of every person they know, if they are still alive, waiting for airdrops to come in, or waiting for delivery trucks to be allowed in, because you remember, Israel holds control over Gaza. You know, they claim to have left Gaza, but still, no one can just go in or out, which defies international law, but I digress. Waiting for aid trucks, hoping that they don't get mowed down when those aid trucks actually arrive. You know, all of these things. And, you know, the horrors of it is just like, in the international community and the relative silence from the international community, not everyone, but certainly from the most powerful nations in the quote-unquote West, who apparently ostensibly stand for international law, and who cried so dearly at Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and, you know, for good reason, suddenly have nothing to say or very little to say about the more than 30,000, 32,000, 33,000 dead Palestinians, 10, 12,000 of which are children. And suddenly nobody has anything to say in among these, you know, big, powerful countries that are actually not only remaining relatively silent, but actually finding ways to fund Israel in their slaughter of Palestinians. And in the face of it, you know, one of the ways that this is justified is that Israel must defend itself. And it's like, okay, but I am curious, like, are they worried that Palestinians might treat them like they've treated Palestinians? Because that would suck, and I wouldn't want that for them. But, you know, I think it's important to be mindful of the hypocrisy and the double standard there. And again, because I know you're listening, I have to dedicate this to that lovely Israeli professor who reached out to me. This is all because of you. And after this episode, just so you know, I'm going to be covering Eichmann in Jerusalem, Hannah Arendt's Eichmann in Jerusalem, and the ways in which the Israeli state have used the Eichmann case as a way to bolster their own violence and as a way to distract from all of the other things that actually went on in Nazi Germany, and how the Nazis had a very developed Zionist project in their early years, and how they collaborated with Zionists to establish their Zionist state. Very interesting. And how they shared a lot of those same interests. I mean, just historical facts. So we'll get into that. Hannah Arendt is so important in that way. But moving on to chapter 3, starting with chapter 3, toward Palestinian self-determination. Now, at the time of writing this, there were about 4 million Palestinians in and out of Palestine. Again, this is the late 70s. Now, those outside of actual Palestinian territory, they were in Lebanon, Jordan, and other Arab states, Egypt, so on around that area, Syria, and many of them were in these other nations because they were exiled. Because remember, the Nakba in 1948 and the years leading up to it, when Zionist colonizers arrived and displaced almost 1 million people from their homes. A million. Almost 800,000, you know, if people are going to yell, oh, it's not 1 million. Okay, 800,000 people from their homes. They were forced to go to all these other states. And this has often been historically used to justify Israel's violence, because Israel has often used this to say, oh, they're so anti-Semitic, that's why they left Palestine, because they didn't like Jewish people. But of course, there's no mention of all of the various militia cells that emerged pre-1948 of Jewish settlers who were actually terrorizing Palestinians. Of course, no mention of that. Like the president of Israel in the 70s, Menachem, who I pronounced very wrongly. Thank you to a certain commenter, Robin Herzig, for correctly, you know, correcting me. I was saying Menachem Begin, as how to pronounce their name, the president of Israel in the mid-70s, who was part of a terrorist organization before Israel was formed that had murdered hundreds of Arabs in Palestinian land, or Palestinians. It's actually pronounced Menachem Begin, if I'm pronouncing that right. And yeah, just a, you know, it's just one reason why people may have left. They were scared, and they knew very well that there were many more Zionist colonizers coming. However, I think it's really important to note, and like, this land has been under contention long before Zionist settlers arrived. There was the Ottoman Empire who had controlled it as well, which was not good either. I mean, colonization is, no matter who's doing it, it's bad. The Ottoman Empire, then the British Empire, who were largely responsible for finally Zionist settlers winding up there, even though there were a lot of tensions between the British and some of the early Zionists. Very complicated issue, but they were, you know, the British wanted them out, and they wanted to still maintain control, whereas the early Zionists there wanted to have their own independence, so that created conflict. And so, there's so many different aspects to that. Now, the difference, I would say, and it's more of a difference in degree rather than kind, but I could be, don't quote me on that, is that with these other empires that took over Palestinian territory, they were not nearly as interested, it seemed, like actually erasing Palestinian identity, Palestinian history, and culture in the way that Israel seems to be. And, this is Edward Said's point, but, this is something that I don't know a whole lot about, specifically the history of the Ottoman Empire there. In any case, you know, take the point and do your own research on it and come back and yell at me if I got it wrong. But I think for the most part, we never saw this kind of similar erasure of Palestinian identity to the point where the very existence of Palestine itself is called into question, even though there are innumerable early Zionist texts using the term Palestine, referring to Palestinians and how they wanted to colonize that territory. Now, the early Zionists, starting out in the late 19th century, so about 70 years, 75 years, give or take, before World War II, they were participating in a steady process of erasing Palestinian heritage. And this would exacerbate in 1948 with the establishment of Israel and the claim that this was just a barren land where no one existed. There were a few people scattered around, but there was no one there. And this is one of the big points I took from that documentary, Israelism, where people are often told in Israel that it was just this empty land, and it pissed off a few neighboring people or the few people who were there, and they just committed their life to trying to eradicate Jews off the earth. Which, it's not historically accurate in any way, but it's a popular narrative that circulates through Israeli discourse about Palestinians. Not all, but a big chunk of it. And this has its roots in the broader project of European Orientalism, or the study of the Orient, that treats the Orient, that is the Arab world, as being identityless, except when that identity can associate negatively with those people as being sexually depraved, as being tyrannical, as being stuck in the past, as being unintelligent, and so on. So after that point, and this was one of the difficulties, and hence the title of this chapter, Toward a Palestinian Self-Determination, is that suddenly Palestinians were forced to establish an identity for themselves. And this is a very, in post-colonial studies, it's a very interesting, it's a pretty violent word to use. It's interesting. I'm just sitting on the outside, just what? Oh, that's fascinating. I don't mean it in that way. It's a very complicated thing, because when people are not threatened by a colonizer, they aren't probably getting together and being like, this is our collective identity. Groups and communities in certain territorial spaces who might share a name, you know, they might share some qualities that they identify among themselves, but they're never expected, they're never forced to be like, let us prove to the international community that we have this identity. And it produces an interesting double bind where, on the one hand, I think we all have an implicit resistance to establishing ourselves or committing ourselves to this single identity. All people do. You know, we're a lot more complicated than that. But on the other hand, Palestinians were forced to then be like, no, we have this identity. We have this identity. Which is kind of like submitting to the very logics of nationalism that birth or that potentiate colonialism in the first place. And I'm not saying they had to do, like, they absolutely had to do that. But it just goes to show how even the solution to the problem often feeds into the very same problem in the first place. Now imagine the difficulty of this, where suddenly Palestinians were forced to try and come up with having the singular, unifying, social, cultural, and political identity as they were losing their homes, as they were being murdered, their children and adults, everyone was being murdered by Israelis who were there, and then they're being told that they need to somehow embrace this identity. And again, this identity is even today called into question. Certain ding-dong actor likes to take to Twitter screaming about how Palestine isn't even like a real thing, except of course when it comes to Hamas, and then all of a sudden every single civilian is extremely political. Like, they have this strong unifying political identity, and that can be used to justify murdering them because they are, they're part of the whole thing and the whole thing is bad, so therefore they can be murdered. Like with that quote we read from last time about from the Israeli general in Lebanon, where he just said flat out, he's like, we don't discern between civilian Arabic civilians and militants, because you can never trust Arabic people. So we don't discern the two. We don't really scrutinize. We just kill whoever we perceive to be threatening, and then they can write that off as being like, oh well, we killed a militant because we perceived them to be that way. So the Palestinian struggle for self-determination and for recognition and identity would be a site or a template for many other anti-colonial struggles, like South Africa, which, again, last time, it's important not to just reduce what is happening or what historically has happened between Israel and Palestine to other conflicts. It is a singular thing on its own and needs to be understood in that way. You can draw from other instances to make sense of it, but that you can't do so if you're going to erase the complexity and the nuance and the specificity of this situation that comes down to the land, the history, the historical persecution of Jews, the Holocaust, Orientalism, the treatment of Arabic people and Muslim people by the West. I mean, all of these things need to be factored in as well to account for the specificity here. Now, they are then a site, and I mean site in two ways, S-I-T-E, they're like a place, and a site, like part of our vision, we can see them, of colonial struggle against an historically oppressed group, that is the Jews. Of course, historically oppressed is like hardly gets at like exactly how much oppression they've experienced. It's like immeasurable. But these are people who are fighting against an oppressed people, an historically oppressed people, and that adds a level of complexity, definitely. And depending on who's looking, Palestinians are either the perfect enemy or the perfect ally or victim. But what remains consistent is a refusal in both cases to listen to Palestinians to testify to their existence as a people outside of their oppression and as a people with many cultures, dialects, identities, hopes, dreams, families, friends, food culture. I mean, it extends music, it extends to everything. And Palestinians have been, because of their being oppressed by the Israeli state and by the earliest Zionist settlers, have been, in the international eye, have been denied this nuance because they've just had to survive. They've been denied this nuance. And even in efforts to ally with them, they've often been reduced to their oppression, which is, there's some importance there. Of course, we can't erase the fact that they're oppressed. But to reduce them to that, and not to be like they're actually culprits here, but to reduce them to that in the sense that there's nothing more to them than that is a way to commit another violence against them. Now, and Edward Said is so clear about this, Palestinians and Palestinian authority hasn't always been amazing. Like, of course, people, and this applies to any nation, and it's of course important to hold, to recognize that. So, for example, many Palestinian refugees, and the term refugees should immediately color our impression of how we're going to interpret what's about to follow, Palestinian refugees in Lebanon and Jordan haven't always been received very well by these countries. So Israel has repeatedly used these tensions as quote-unquote evidence of Palestinian restlessness, uncontrollability, stubbornness, backwardsness has often been used against them. And we see this today with many commentators saying things along the lines, if Palestinians are innocent victims, why doesn't Egypt accept them? Why doesn't Egypt accept them through the Sinai Peninsula into their territory? Why doesn't they accept the 2 million Palestinians? And this is probably because that's an enormous task. Just accepting 2 million people. No state can just so easily welcome in 2 million refugees through one border point over a few days. That's very difficult. And there's a lot more to it. In the next chapter, later in this episode, we're going to look more at the Camp David Accords. And specifically, the very problematic place that Egypt has occupied in this whole conflict. And the way that Egypt really cozied up with Israel in the early 90s. Early 90s through the 80s. I mean, they've had kind of an ambiguous place here, and it explains Egypt's relative, their apathy towards the Palestinian people. I say very being kind of extreme, but their indifferent view towards Palestinians. And by they, I mean the Egyptian political class. The people are very much on the side of Palestinians. It's amazing how we let our political leaders are just so detached from the people's will globally. Just very interesting. So to return to the topic of coming up with a Palestinian identity, at least they were forced to, in order to be seen, to even be recognized by the international community as being worthy of defense, being worthy of sympathy, and trying to do so while being occupied by an invading nation. I can't even fathom, it is just so impossible for me to fathom what life is like in those situations. And there's so many Palestinian writers, there's Mahmoud Darwish, Ghassan Hanafani, Naib Mahfouz, who all have captured in some measure the impossibility of unifying a culture, and especially a culture under occupation, beyond their being unified as occupied. So they're put in a situation where they're expected to adopt this identity and show it to the world and be like, we are worthy of saving because we have this culture, we have this identity, as though just them just being human is not enough to justify their them being able to have rights, to have freedom, to not be occupied, as though their being human is not enough. And to do so while being occupied without their identity being that of their being occupied. I hope I'm being clear about that. Because occupation essentially forces oppressed groups to erase their distinctions that they have within that group. There's no perfectly homogenous group that doesn't exist to offer a real Palestinian identity. I mean, just look at Israel. I mean, people in Jerusalem look at Tel Aviv like this, like, club haven for young 20-year-old people just trying to get laid, whereas Tel Aviv views Jerusalem. I mean, there's no country on earth that has this unified national identity. I don't know, maybe North Korea? I don't know. I've never been there, though. But, like, that doesn't exist. Like, it just doesn't exist. And yet Palestinians were forced to do that. And the PLO has been really effective at, historically at the time, they've been really effective at representing a common Palestinian identity. But again, it comes at a kind of violence because you have to erase all the nuance and differences in the form of this one representative government, which I'm saying they had to do it. But this just shows that the solution is part of the problem, you know, contributes to it. And the PLO under Arafat, of course, it's silly. The earliest reference I have of Arafat was from Die Hard, when Hans Gruber is like talking about the suit he's wearing, or the suit that the CEO is wearing of the place he's trying to rob, and he's like, oh yeah, Arafat got his there. I was like, who's Arafat? And I remember looking it up. But yeah, so anyways, so the PLO has been really effective, especially under Arafat, to establish this common Palestinian identity, this will and desire for freedom, without standing in for Palestinians themselves, you know, without necessarily being like, we are speaking for all Palestinians. Its founder, that is Arafat, he led the Fatah against Israeli forces to try reclaim Palestinian land and autonomy. Operating out of Jordan and Lebanon, they were opposed on the basis of their nationalist aspirations. And this is a very theoretically complicated thing, where at the time in the 70s and 80s, as Reaganism, as globalized laissez-faire capitalism was really taking foot, and Thatcherism all across the world, we saw a turning away from national identity in favor of like free market type, open borders type of economic systems really flourishing. And at the same time, Palestinians were trying to establish a kind of national identity. And this was used by the international community in the West to be like, oh, look how much they're stuck in the past, that they care so much about national identity now, given that they just have to open themselves up to the spectral light of the capitalist economy, which is exactly, as we'll find out, I'll dig into in a few minutes, exactly what Egypt did. Egypt was like, yes, let us open ourselves up to the capitalist economy. We don't care about our, like, all this, the land that much. I mean, it's really just about our borders. I mean, it's just really about opening up to the economy, which they used to leverage them earning back the Sinai Peninsula that they lost in 67 in the Six-Day War between Israel and the neighboring Arab states, to gain that back and to also, I guess, make a vow, kind of tacit vow, that they'd hold an indifferent stance towards Israel and its treatment of the Palestinians. Now, of course, the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, has been branded a terrorist group, despite them avoiding and condemning terror. And as Saeed writes, stripped of its context, an act of Palestinian desperation looks like wanton murder. What is too often scandalously ignored and unreported in the U.S. is that events like the Mallet incident of May 1974 were preceded by weeks of sustained Israeli napalm bombings of Palestinian refugee camps. And this was happening in Lebanon, where the Mallet incident was a incident. I mean, the violence of this can't be understated, where Palestinians kidnapped hundreds or tens of children from a school, resulting in the deaths of about 22 children and a few more adults, which is, like, obviously horrible, like, in 74. But all Edward Said is saying is, like, okay, we hear a lot about that, and rightfully we should. I mean, in cases where children are dying, of course we need to hear about that. But he's like, why didn't we hear about the weeks, months, years of bombing of refugee camps in Lebanon, which is not Palestine, of Lebanon, by the Israeli military, killing hundreds of people and children. Like, why don't we hear about their deaths? I mean, again, I believe in equality. I'm a rationalist. I believe in equality, equity. Why is it that we pay disproportionate attention to one national death, national identity person's death, than another? You know, all life should be equal. So given all this, Saeed is like, Palestinians can learn a thing or two from Israelis and their Zionist aspirations, because much of their justification for establishing the State of Israel was that they were an oppressed people without a state. And because they don't have a state, they are subject to indiscriminate harm. And Saeed is like, okay, well, why can't we say the same thing about Palestinians? I mean, they satisfy all three of those criteria. They are a people who have been branded by the Israeli government as not having a state. Well, historically, not having a state, being a stateless people. They've suffered immeasurable harm, 100,000 deaths by now over the course of 75 years or more, like so innumerable deaths. It's just like, there's no comparison. I don't mean a comparison between Jews and Palestinians, like in terms of deaths, but I mean, like, it should be applicable in both cases, right? Like, why can't Palestinians make the same argument? It's like, it just makes sense. And that puts us here into chapter 4, the Palestinian question after Camp David. So Camp David was a secret meeting between, it happened in Maryland under President Jimmy Carter, with Egypt and Israel, in which they were supposed to, because Jimmy Carter of all the presidents, Jimmy Carter made a little bit of headway in actually acknowledging that Palestinians are people who deserve rights, which the Israelis were like, absolutely not. Very haunting stuff. Very haunting response to something as lukewarm as saying that they are a people who deserve protection. So specifically, these accords took place in the late 70s. I said the early 90s before that. Those are the Oslo accords. So yeah, ignore that. But anyways, so the Camp David Accords happening in the late 70s were secret meetings between Israel and Egypt in 1978 to return the Sinai Peninsula. So, I mean, geographically, if you can envision where's currently Israel on the map and Gaza in the southwest, like a kind of a southwest quadrant of like where Israel has taken all Palestinian land since 48, the Sinai Peninsula is just south of that. So you know how you go from Gaza and then there's Egypt? After 67, a huge chunk of that land that's Egypt's was actually taken over by Israel in the Six-Day War. And so the 78 Camp David Accords were a way by which Egypt might actually regain that land in the Sinai Peninsula, which, I mean, Israel didn't have a big attachment to. They were like, it was too much land for them anyways, especially at the time, to want to take over, and it didn't have the same kind of significance to them. So they were in a great position as a bargaining chip, being like, yeah, okay, take it back, but do all this stuff for us. One of the other things that they discussed at the Camp David Accords, at the Camp David meetings, was giving the West Bank, giving Palestinians autonomy over the West Bank, which of course didn't happen. And the very fact that at these meetings, Palestinians were denied a voice at the table speaks volumes of just the West's view of Palestinians. Like they don't have a voice. It's like really the "Can the Subaltern Speak" by Spivak. Like they're just denied a voice. They're denied any opportunity to actually express themselves and to say that they are a people with dreams and hopes, or just being a people, period, that deserve protection. Like we know from Hannah Arendt, the most important thing is that someone has the right to have rights, that and we must respect that for every single human being. Now, one of the other subtle purposes or outcome of the Camp David Accords is that it would guarantee the U.S.'s perpetual presence in that region of the world. So they would have some kind of a stake in it and some kind of a, you know, proxy place there. Where Said is clear about this, that the immediate material reason is oil. I mean, their oil interests were going much easier to secure if you have an ally state in the region, that is Israel to the Palestinians, or to the U.S. If you have Israel for the U.S. And like we talked about last time, one of the things that really comes about through that is that Israel is framed within the U.S. not as an international issue or an issue of international relations or like foreign diplomacy or whatever. It is a domestic issue. And we see that on display in the way that like any criticism of Israel is immediately branded as anti-Semitism in the U.S. and you risk losing your job, being subject to doxing, ending up on some ADL list or Canary Watch or something. You get harassed with like numerous emails from organizations that are like claiming to, you know, defend Jewish people for criticizing Israel. And we really see it in the U.S. and other countries in the quote-unquote West that to criticize Israel is to suddenly become a domestic concern for the country that you're in. Whereas historically, just denying the existence of Palestinians or criticizing Palestinians meant nothing. No one would care. No one even bat an eye. It was just like, yes, of course, you're doing it. You're saying the exact right thing. Amazing. And this would also allow or really ramp up the U.S. is supplying Israel with funds. Like, the U.S. gives so much money to Israel. It's like, why? It's way beyond what any country would need for actual self-defense. And none of the other states want to get involved. I mean, isn't this a sign that, like, they're not on the brink of war? I mean, as I'm recording this, there's the threat of Iran going in. But that's because Israel just attacked their embassy, which is like, good going. And everyone's like, oh, the guy deserved it. It's like, well, it's still a crime. Doesn't matter if the guy deserved it. It's still a crime. An international crime. Which, like, what? But in any case, that's what we're confronting. But, like, it's clear that the neighboring states are not interested in getting into a war with Israel. At least, I mean, I'm no geopolitical expert in any way. Doesn't seem like it. And it seems like overkill with the amount of money and funds and weapons that the U.S. is sending Israel and that sends Israel on a yearly basis. And the Camp David Accords were also a way by which to tell the world and to tell the whole Arabic community and all the Arab states that they'll be fine if they play the U.S.'s game with the U.S.'s rules in that region of the world, which is certainly what Egypt did. Now, of course, I mean, the Camp David agreements did not so much as even acknowledge all the illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. You know, the West Bank where there's no Hamas? One commentator was like, well, that's not technically true. There's some comment on one of the videos. And you're right. Like, there's like, that's not technically true. There are Hamas people there. And like, yeah, okay, fine. There are people there, but this doesn't justify the settlements is all I'm saying. Like, they aren't part of the government. Like, that's, sure, there might be some people there running in their own underground cells and stuff, but that's not the point that I'm trying to make. Like, Israel has been encroaching upon the West Bank for decades, just setting up settlements, taking territory illegally as it is recognized by the international community and the UN. And they didn't even so much as acknowledge this at Camp David, or to be like, hey, Israel, like, is this really necessary that you're taking all of this land? Is this really necessary? But didn't so much as mention it. Or the occupation of Gaza, for that matter. Now, it was a different landscape 50 years ago when this was happening, but I mean, none of this was being mentioned. In protest, Halul's citizens took to the streets in that neighborhood of Halul. In response, the Israeli military killed two people, one of whom was a child, and imposed a 23-hour curfew on the whole town, which is, wow. Did you hear about that in the news? No. Well, it was years ago, but justified because, as Carter said, the PLO is as bad as the Nazis. Like they equ- and this they repeatedly do this, equate Palestinians with the Nazis as though they're the absolute worst human beings on the planet, as the Nazis were. Which I really hope that, you know, if you made it this far, you'll tune in to Eichmann in Jerusalem. Because I don't know if there's a book I've been more lied about in my life than Eichmann in Jerusalem. Because it's fascinating to hear about the early Zionist aspirations of the Nazis. Very fascinating. All to justify encroaching on that territory and taking it from Palestinians. But, I mean, this and not beyond that, they were associating Palestinians with the KKK and the communists. But it's like, this is all just moral panic stuff. It's all just meant to justify Israel's use of violence against Palestinians. Like, as though every Palestinian is synonymous with Hamas. Or at this time with the PLO, because that's way before Hamas. Hamas was, what, 2006, 2007? Like, like as though the conflict started with Hamas when that's not even 20 years old, and this has been going on for a century now, more or less, as far as some the earliest settlements, illegal settlements being established on Palestinian territory. And this view of the Palestinians as being worse or just as bad as the Nazis played out in the media's treatment of Arafat, as he was asked repeatedly about being an anti-Semite. But no one would dare ask Begin why he started an anti-Arab terrorist cell before Israel was even formed, and openly states in his book that he wants to annex the West and East Bank and paints every Palestinian as a threat, as a killable threat. Of course, no one asked them that, you know. So there's this unequal treatment of Palestinians, of course, and Israelis by the Western media class to justify, to manufacture consent for Israeli violence. Now, in part, Camp David was Egypt's success story at making inroads against Israel to some extent, not only to regain the Sinai Peninsula, which, like, I don't think Israel had much interest in keeping anyways, but to show the world the deep connection between Israel and the U.S. Egypt also sought to get away from the Arab nationalists and the other hyper, at least this is how it was painted, Arab nationalism at the time. And as this was going on, like this was right before the Iranian revolution, 1979 revolution, where there was a resurgence in this intense Arab nationalism. And Egypt didn't want a part of that because, like I said, at the time, nationalism would be viewed by the West as being this thing of the past. You know, it's like, oh, you're stuck with your nation. I mean, you have to embrace instead a cosmopolitan global capitalism. If you're not doing that, then you're just falling behind. Egypt essentially sought entrance into the capitalist world order and, like, viewed Palestinian struggles as a hindrance to this process and as contributing to general unrest in the Middle East. But this is just a victim blame. I mean, of course, there was Arabic, like, association with and solidarity with the Palestinian struggle, and this would motivate much resistance to Western-backed governments within the Middle East. But still, I mean, we can't ignore that many Arab states, despite being quite rich a lot of the time, have not been quite as helpful to the Palestinians as they could be, and they could have been. Probably because they knew that, siding with the Palestinians would mean that they were fighting against the U.S., which just goes to show that the state of the U.S. global order is something you're not allowed to oppose. So much for democracy. So Saeed suggests that Israel and Egypt's peace treaty solidified a distinction in the Middle East between haves and have-nots, where the latter, the have-nots, were associated with Arabic extremism. And the Iranian Revolution confirmed these concerns to the Americans that would happen like a year later, or even a few months later. The irony was that Begin was Israel's prime minister, who was an ex-terrorist at the time, and no one would bat an eye about his extremity, his extremism, and his view of Palestinians as being extreme. Because the very ability to recognize extremism depends upon you viewing the victims of extremism as being human. And if you don't view Palestinians as human, it doesn't matter what violence is inflicted against them, you'd never brand their murder as being extreme. Like, even as the U.S. right now is in the most basic way showing some amount of resistance to Israeli murder of Palestinians, they would never go so far as to say that Israel is an extremist state. They would never do that. But, of course, they're willing to brand this of Iran, Afghanistan, now, like, so many other Middle Eastern countries throughout the world, historically, like, who gets to be called an extremist? Who gets to be called a terrorist, for example? So Israel could give back the Sinai Peninsula, earn Egypt's indifference, and then keep encroaching upon Palestinian territory. It's impossible, I think, not to view Israel's current demolition of Gaza as just an extension of the broader Israeli project to take over all the land. I don't know, I just can't see it as otherwise. Just my opinion, but it certainly looks that way. It seems to belong to this historical trajectory. Now, it must be noted that Camp David Accords included a reduction in Israel's military presence in Palestine. This was a part of it. But that didn't stop ultra-Orthodox groups like the Gush Emunim establishing settlements in West Bank, Gaza, and Golan Heights. And this was an extremist right-wing or Jewish Orthodox group that were setting up settlements like just for this, because they believed fundamentally this was their holy land and Palestinians were just getting in the way of that. And they did so because it was their God-given right, they viewed. They were a terrorist group planning to destroy temples and civilian homes, and they still hold much sway. The group doesn't exist anymore under that name. They still hold much sway in legitimating Israel's illegal settlements and outposts. Where Camp David granted Israel the right to fight subversion without specifying what subversion necessarily means. So they can just call anything they want subversion and justify fighting against it in any way that they see fit. So if Israel interprets Palestinian autonomy as subversion, for example, which is, I mean, this is a clever trick, then they have a so-called right to defend themselves by attacking Palestine and Palestinians. And when engaging this topic, it is useful to draw upon other situations like South African apartheid, like I said, but not to reduce it to that. Because the specificity here can't be ignored. And it also participates, like I said, in silencing Palestinians with the enlightened, quote-unquote, West, telling them how to understand their oppression. It's like, oh, your oppression is like this group's oppression, or it's like that group's oppression, which is just another colonial tool to speak for an oppressed group, even if, again, it's useful. At the time, too, the U.S. wouldn't even engage with the PLO unless it agreed to recognize Israel's right to existence, which is like, I can't even think of an analogy. It's like if a burglar breaks into your house and the cops won't show up unless you say that, yeah, the burglar has a right to your spare bedroom. It's like, like, unless you admit that they have a right to that spare bedroom, you are not going to talk to us. Like, what? Explain that to me. And like I said, at the time, and we've seen this since this forever, you can't even criticize Israel without being called an anti-Semite. Or in 1978, when Israel illegally invaded Lebanon, so not even Palestine or Palestinian territory, you couldn't even criticize it without being called an anti-Semite. Or today, that, or being called a Hamas supporter or a supporter of terrorism or whatever nonsense some ding-dong on Twitter is going to scream about now. So the PLO's nationalist aspirations and national efforts, they galvanized Palestinian resistance to Zionism. And these efforts belonged to and contributed to a long battle of Arabic opposition to Western influence in the Middle East, which the West has had a long historical influence there from, you know, their first colonial efforts from hundreds of years ago in these areas, the French and Egypt and Napoleon and Egypt and the entire enterprise of Orientalism. The West's treatment of the Middle East, like, I really hope that there will be a day when we will be able to look back and actually acknowledge it for all the horror that it was and be making amends for that. You know, I say we, meet for those of us listening who are in the West and who have, you know, this isn't something I've lived through. It's something I've inadvertently contributed to in the media I've consumed. The entire, you know, all films in the US 80s and 90s where the terrorists were from Lebanon or Syria or something, like Middle Eastern terrorists, or like my tax dollars going to governments that fund these efforts. Like, I hope one day we will be able to really make amends. I really hope. And to truly do so as well with the indigenous people in the lands that we currently occupy in North America, for those of us that aren't indigenous from these areas, or whose ancestors weren't forced here through like the Atlantic slave trade. Now, one of the solutions put forth in the past is a secular one-state solution. And while it has its merits, of course there are some shortcomings to it, like what is important no matter what about this, even if it's not a perfect solution to this problem. What is important, though, is that it opposed Zionism's natural claim to the land. You know, the kind of manifest destiny that they, you know, they have a God-given right to that land. One state solution might oppose that, where if you actually have Palestinian people being able to vote equally and to live alongside Israelis, I'm not saying this is a solution, but it has its possible benefits in that way. Now, to this suggestion, though, Israel and the West branded this as a call for genocide against Israelis, while Israel was doing the same thing. Like, and I've already talked about this, but like, calling what's going on now a genocide or settler colonialism, people interpret as a call for genocide or settler colonialism, where it's like, oh, you're going to call what Israel's doing a genocide? Oh, therefore you think that Israel should be genocided. And I'm like, if you cared that much about a word and not care about the more than 30,000 dead people in Gaza, innocent people in Gaza, or as they like to say, oh, half of them are actually secret Hamas operatives. Fine, like, which isn't true, but imagine if which has been confirmed by The Lancet and other independent organizations, by the way. But even if it was true, 15,000 people, which I'm not saying is true, why is that not enough to recognize the disproportionate response that Israel has mounted here? But that, you know, people would rather get upset about the word you use to describe it. Fine, don't call it a genocide. Don't call it settler colonialism. We'll call it, you're killing a shitload of people, of innocent people, and it has to stop. You know, like, that, fine. Like, we'll determine the word, we'll figure out the words later, but stop. Or like how From the River to the Sea is a call for genocide as well. Meanwhile, Israel has just taken all that land. Is that then genocide? Because if saying that Palestinians want their land back is genocide, then how do we even begin to imagine what Israel has done in taking all that land in the first place? Like, I really hope the Israelis who are really pissed about From the River to the Sea are proportionately pissed at the actual actions that have taken, allowed them to take From the River to the Sea. Because I'm just a rationalist here. I believe in equality. I believe in equity. I believe in being fair. I'm a diehard liberal in that way, aren't I? I'm very committed to, you know, I'm a Kantian, for God's sakes. I believe in the categorical imperative. And then when Arafat was running for, was struggling for Palestinian independence in the 70s, Israel branded him a Nazi baby killer. Sound familiar? The 40 beheaded babies in Israel, all the contention around that. Like, where is the actual evidence for that? Is it true? I mean, I wonder what the actual situation is, given that all the, and Haaretz is, even the Israeli journal, being like, I don't know if we have evidence for that. I mean, and I don't know. We can take it on faith, but like, there is a long history of just branding Palestinian actions or Palestinians as being baby killers. Now, it's important to see that Israel's rhetorical strategies have been around for a while. It's like with their trick that, oh, we warn them first so we can then kill them. We dropped pamphlets so they knew, so it's their fault for not leaving. Then we bombed all their homes to rubble. Now, Arafat's government was given two symbolic options. Accept that they have no right to the land because it all belongs to Israel. or refuse and be steadily encroached upon and violated until Israel's job is complete. So let me rephrase that. Okay, the actual truth of it would probably be more like this. So they have two options. Arafat would have two options. Accept that they have no right to the land because it all belongs to Israel, and then Israel will come in and take it, or refuse, and then Israel will come and take it. So if you're confronted with those two options, well, I mean, but in Texans listening, I mean, Texans are a good example. Texans love their freedom. Well, what do you think you'd do? You'd think you'd say, oh, yes, actually, yeah, it's your land. Come and take my house. Or better yet, drop pamphlets down telling me to leave, or I'll be bombed into oblivion. I bet a lot of Americans would be down for that, actually. I bet they really would. You know how Americans hate their freedom? They love state power so much. I bet they'd be so down for that. Now, of course, Saeed is totally aware of the history of Jewish persecution. It's like this thing that always haunts these discussions, and it's something we know about and something we learn about to death, and rightfully so, especially the Holocaust. Rightfully so, we learn about this, and we learn about it so much. It's so important. But we don't hear about Palestinians. We don't hear about all of the Palestinian struggles that have been going on for 100 years and the violence that they've experienced. But this long history of oppression against Jewish people, it should not crystallize or transform into violence then against Palestinians. It just doesn't make sense. And this hatred towards Palestinians runs so deep that even, rights-focused, liberal Israeli groups, they are hardly fighting for the Palestinian cause. It's more like, oh, well, would they even take out the illegal settlements, or they'll just be like, we won't make more? Are they going to give land back? Reset up 1967 borders before they were taken, And where was the outcry at the time, 1978, when 250,000 Lebanese people, so people of another country, 250,000 lost their homes in 1978 because of Israel's invasion. So the Palestinian Project is a project for peace if you view Palestinians as people. And why is it right for a Jew born in Chicago to immigrate to Israel, whereas a Palestinian born in Jaffa is a refugee, or Nablus, or Jerusalem is a refugee? They don't actually have a right to the land. But a Jewish person born in Chicago has a birthright to that land, to actual territory. They always have a place to go in Israel. It's like, my God, it's unbelievable. And I just want to read his closing sentences here before, and then we'll go into the epilogue, which is short, but his closing sentences. But we must not forget that Palestine is also saturated with blood and violence, and we must look forward realistically to much turbulence, with ugly human waste in the short term. Unhappily, the question of Palestine will renew itself in all too well-known forms, but so too will the people of Palestine, Arabs and Jews, whose past and future ties them inexorably together. Their encounter has yet to occur on any important scale, but it will occur, I know, and it will be to their mutual benefit. And I mean, these are beautiful lines. I just wish I shared of course, he wouldn't live to see what's happening now. And I certainly hope he's right, that one day it will be to their mutual benefit, and that these people will be able to share that land, hopefully with Palestinians getting amends, compensated, getting land back, and being able to live peacefully together. Because, that has to be the outcome, but that can't happen. I mean, Israel has been getting more and more violent towards Palestinians as, Palestinian violence has been going down. And it's like, I don't know. I really want to share the optimism, but sometimes it's really hard. And that puts us here just into the epilogue, where here he's talking about the Oslo Accords and the Middle East Peace Conference in the early 90s. Well, the Middle East Peace Conference in 1991 in Madrid? I think it was in Madrid. It brought together many different countries. It brought together Israel, the Palestinians, Jordan, Syria, and Egypt. But here are the Palestinians that refer, and the U.S., of course, this refers to a small delegation as part of Jordan's delegation, and included no PLO members, refugee representation, and no one from East Jerusalem. Very important to add. And couldn't help but feel that this was punishment for the PLO's support of Iraq in its occupation of Kuwait. Ironic, given Israel's occupation of Palestine. You know, of course, Iraq going into Kuwait was, like, rightfully so, not good. But why don't we apply the same standard to Israel? Ironic, too, that the UN was denied a seat at the table, probably because they were blowing the whistle on Israel's relentless violence. Because the UN was like, y'all, we set this up following the horrors of World War II, and we're seeing horrors on display now. We're seeing Israel's encroachment of Palestine and Palestinians, and it seems as though Israel was not too fond of these revelations and wanted to keep them from this table. In the face of this, I mean, if you want more on it, you can read the details of the Middle East Peace Conference and then the Oslo Accords. But in the face of this, I mean, his solution, and I think he's right, like, of one of the best solutions, is that we must boycott, divest, and sanction. Is what's called BDS. We must boycott, divest, and sanction Israel and make support contingent on their giving back stolen land and making amends with Palestinians, because they currently, it's our tax dollars in the US here and Canada and other quote unquote Western countries that are supporting this and supporting Israel's occupation of Palestine. So these are just some of the things that have to be done. I mean, there's so much more that has to be done. Raising public consciousness in any moment we can to never stop talking about this. And, you know, to know that other things like this are happening all around the world too, in so many different ways. The oppression of the Uyghur people, what's going on in Yemen, what went on in Yemen, what's going on in the Congo, so many other places, persecuted people all across the planet who've been oppressed, who've been colonized, and all of these things need to be front and center in our minds all the time. It's not something we can just hide away from or pretend doesn't exist. I mean, we have an obligation to them, and we have an obligation to our descendants, for those of us that choose to have children and people that we care about, that we leave them a world that's better than the one we entered, I think. I mean, I think that that's, let alone the climate catastrophe we're all facing. And yeah, if you can, donate to one of the organizations I've listed below, and stay tuned for Eichmann in Jerusalem, because I think it's important to confront some of Hannah Arendt's observations in that book. And yeah, on that note, if I got anything wrong, let me know. Or anything I should have mentioned, put it in the comments and I can pin it and we can all see. And yeah, on that note, take care.